Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Awilco Drilling PLC second quarter 2015 conference call. My name is Rosie, and I'll be your coordinator for today's conference. For the duration of the call, you'll be on listen only. If at any time you need assistance, please press star zero on your telephone keypad and you'll be connected to an operator. I'll now hand you over to your host, John Oliver Bryce, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosie, for that introduction. Welcome to Awilco Drilling's Q2 earnings call. Myself, John Oliver Bryce, I'm the CEO, and with me on the call today is Ian Wilson, also our CFO. For those of you who have access to the internet, for this call, we'll be roughly following the format of the Q2 presentation, which is on Awilco Drilling's website under the investor relations section. During the call then, we will be talking about highlights from the quarter. We'll be going into the numbers in a bit more detail. We'll then move on to an operational update, followed by a market outlook summary, and then we will go to the Q&A, which will be coordinated by Rosie. Starting with the highlights then, that's section one on the presentation if you have it in front of you, and we're on to page five. Highlights from the quarter. Well, it was a good quarter. In respect to this quarter, Awilco Drilling will be paying a dividend of $0.50 per share. That's been generated by revenue from the quarter of $69 million with an EBITDA number of $50.3. Our operating cost or our OpEx during the quarter was approximately $87,900 per day per rig, and that's within guidance. The company's total contract backlog at the end of the quarter was $371 million. That included both the Hess and Apache contracts at the end of the quarter. Those results then were driven by very good performance, as I mentioned, from revenue efficiency of 97.3%. Let's move on to section two, for those of you who have the presentation, and look at the numbers in a bit more detail. We're going to start with slide eight, and that is the balance sheet. Ian Wilson, our CFO, can I ask you to walk us through slide eight?
Okay. We're just going to change that to page seven, which will be the income statement, the condensed statement of contract income.
Got it.
The total revenue for the quarter, $69 million, as John mentioned, representing the 97.3% revenue efficiency. Rig operating expenses of $16 million, equating to $87,900 a day, which was in the midpoint of our prior quarter guidance of $85,000-$90,000 per day. The G&A expense, $2.5 million, is slightly lower due to a reversal of an LTIP provision, but primarily in line with expectation. Depreciation also consistent with the prior quarter at $4.5 million. Total expense is $23.2 million, resulting in operating profit of $45.8 million. Interest expense of $2.1 million in respect of the bond interest, once again consistent with the prior quarter, and total net financial items of $1.7 million, resulting in profit before tax of $44.1 million. The tax expense of $8.8 million, just less than the 20%, which is the U.K. prevailing tax rate, resulting in net profit of $35.3 million and equivalent to $1.18 earnings per share, and on a year-to-date basis, $2.48 earnings per share. Onto the following page, which is the balance sheet. The assets that we have, the rigs, machinery, and equipment, $250 million, being a slight addition during the course of the quarter, and depreciation slightly in excess, in fact, of the additions. $250 million for rigs, machinery, and equipment. Going on to the current assets, the trade and other receivables and the prepayments and accrued revenue. Both the receivables and the accrued revenue, which has since been billed, and all have actually been received in terms of cash. No outstanding issues with regards to receivables. Cash and cash equivalents, a healthy bank balance of $86.4 million, and current tax of $59.5 million as a current tax asset. and that number should be read in conjunction with the liability in respect of current tax payable of $76 million to look at the net impact of what future corporation tax will actually be paid. So total assets, $452 million, onto the liabilities with the capital, and it remains unchanged. Retained earnings increased slightly to $107.7 million. The long-term interest-bearing debt, no movement. So it's a slight decrease during the course of the quarter. So $105 million plus the $10 million current portion. So total bond amount outstanding, $115 million. And as I mentioned before, the current tax payable is the biggest liability, and the current liabilities at 76.4. So total equity and liabilities, $452 million.
Okay, thanks Ian for keeping right on the pages. Just before we move off slide 8 then, do you want to make a comment on impairment?
Yes, we on a quarterly basis take a view with regard to the impairment calculation, and we look at the current contract backlog and the likely potential income on a go-forward basis through the remaining life of the asset. And due to the high level of contract backlog that we've got, combined with the fact that these assets were acquired at a relatively low price, certainly during the course or as at the end of quarter two, we do not have an impairment issue. I think it's fair to say that as we progress through future quarters, depending what happens with regard to future market conditions, that situation may change. But certainly with regard to quarter two, we do not have an impairment issue.
Okay, excellent comment, Ian. So let's go on to section three then, operational update. We'll start with Avoca Drilling's contract status. As of today, current contract backlog sits at $293 million, and that reflects the Will Phoenix's Apache contract only. So those of you that have this slide 10 in front of you, you can see the contract status there for the two rigs, the Will Hunter and the Will Phoenix. So let me start with the Will Hunter. The Will Hunter then was released early from the Hess contract, and remember that contract was firmed till the 1st of December this year, but we agreed with Hess to release the rig from that contract at the end, towards the end of July, and that was in, we agreed an early release payment, which meant there was no negative financial repercussions from this termination to the contract from either parties. So at the moment that rig sits in Invergordon and it's being actively marketed, and it is in warm stack or hot stack condition. So that's the Will Hunter. And the yard stay for that rig, if you're looking at slide 10, you can see that it is there shown at the end of Q2 2016, but we have not completely committed to that SPS, so we have the opportunity to defer that depending on market opportunities. So the Will Phoenix then, the Will Phoenix is working for Apache, and that contract is firm until approximately towards the end of Q4 2017, and there are options at the end of that. The yard stay is shown on the slide at the start of 2016, though we do have the option to at the moment start it at the end of 15 from around about November time, but that depends on a lot of factors. So the SPS there within the Apache firm contract and the total contract backlog for the company at this moment in time is $293 million. Okay, moving on to slide 11 then, let's talk about operational performance. Very good operational performance in the quarter. You can see that there from 96.7% operational uptime. So the rigs worked really well. OPEX in Q2, as I mentioned before, was in accordance with guidance of $87,000 per day per rig, approximately. During the quarter, Avoca Drilling still received positive customer feedback, and that was very much key to mutually beneficial termination or completion, early completion of the Hess contract. They were very pleased with the performance of the Will Hunter. Also, during the quarter, Wilco Drilling attained the ISO or the OHSAS 18001 safety standard for the quarter, which means Wilco Drilling then now operates 9001, 14001, and 18001 quality, environmental, and safety standards. And that really helps in terms of Wilco Drilling marketing rigs going forward. So those are the main operational highlights from the quarter. Moving on then to slide 12, if you have the presentation, touching on the upcoming SPS yard stay projects. First point to mention then, we have a very experienced project team in place for this work, and the planning started for this work in 2013. The budget for the SPS projects remains unchanged, $20 million per rig. The budget for the BOPs, the new BOPs, remains unchanged at $22.5 million per rig. The Wilh Phoenix, as I mentioned before, is scheduled for either late 2015 or early 2016. The Wilh Hunter SPS, however, is scheduled for late Q2 16. However, as I mentioned before, this is dependent on sufficient follow-on work being secured. So those are the highlights from the upcoming SPS. Moving on to then the distribution of the dividend. Very simply, Wilco Drilling is announcing a dividend of 50 cents per share in respect to the quarter. The dates you can see on page 13 of the presentation if you have them, and that is the dividends payable on 25th of September. It will trade ex-dividend on the 25th of August. Just a reminder then, the company's dividend policy remains unchanged, and this is the company intends to distribute all free cash flow over and above a robust cash buffer to support operational working capital requirements and capital expenditure, including the SPS. And a rider there to finish, current levels of a dividend will continue to be challenged by upcoming capital expenditure and the future market prospects. Okay, moving forward from the dividend, let's touch on the market, which is section 4, and looking at slide 15, if you have it in front of you, and this illustrates where the UK midwater semi-submersible market is at the moment. That slide tells us a couple of things, that day rates for new fixtures, there are still some fixtures within the quarter, modest as they were, though. There was a couple of, there was one at $209,000 a day, one at $220,000, and there was also one for North Atlantic Drilling on the West Phoenix. It was a bit of a complicated award, but that was roughly $278,000 for that higher spec rig. So three fixtures within the quarter. So there is a bit of a contracting activity still in the UK. One other tell you can see on the slide 15. There's a bit of a gap between a red and a blue line shown on the graph, and the red line, sorry, those two lines show the total supply of rigs, and you can see a widening, which means that an increased number of rigs are coming off contract and going into layup. So slide 15 tells you the day rate situation and also shows you the UK fleet utilisation in this cool market of 2015. If you then look at slide 16, if you have it, you can see the UK fleet, the different drilling contractors and the names of the rigs that are located in the UK. I guess the main change from this quarter compared to last is the emergence of some red dots in the list of rigs. And the red dots basically mean that the rig has come off contract, has been stacked, but has also gone straight to cold stack. So we can see from the 25 semi-submersibles operating in the UK, six have gone to cold stack stored in inshore waters on the east coast of the UK. And over and above that, you can see the Wilh Hunter still being shown as warm stacked going forward. Now, we will continue to monitor that situation. When the rig is warm stacked, we feel it's in a good position to be marketed, but at the same time, we continue to review the situation in terms of its prospects because, obviously, warm stacked or hot stacked comes at a cost. So that is the fleet status, 25 rigs, 6 cold, and the rest you can see on contract coming off at various points within the end of 15 and 16. On to slide 17. Again, if you have the presentation, and this slide is titled Timing of Return to Higher Activity Levels Remains Unknown. So what we can say, there's uncertainty in the market still prevails. Brent, clearly in the last quarter, has come up again, just underneath 50 at this moment in time. Operators have responded during this year with their reductions in planned E&P spending. UK government, though, has attempted to put stimulus into the UK market with some tax incentives. We haven't seen a step change in activity from this yet, but we're hopeful this will make an impact at some point in the near future. Then the next point to mention, as I mentioned in slide 16, the previous slide, there is an increased number of available rigs now and expected to continue through the remainder of 15 and 16. And what's happening to those rigs? Well, there is a reduced number of contract opportunities, so this is leading to some rigs going to cold stack, and then also in some cases some rigs being attrition candidates. And we've seen two leave the UK. We've seen Transocean's JW McLean and Arctic 3 have been sent for scrap, and the remainder of the idle rigs going to cold. So a sort of cooling picture, but it's probably worth remembering that once a rig goes to cold scrap, to cold stack, that is a bit of an indication that the operator is taking a long-term view of the rig being out of service, and there's obviously a reactivation project and cost, etc., to get it back into the market. So marketing a hot-stacked or warm-stacked rig is potentially a bit easier, and that's the position we find ourselves in, Will Hunter. So we're very much positioning ourselves with our previous track record and keeping the rig hot, in the hope that we can secure some work in the near future. Okay, so that was some notes on the timing of the return to higher activity levels. Let's move on to one of the final slides then, the summary. So the summary from the quarter then, it was a good quarter. We are announcing a 50-cent dividend. This is based on very good performance, revenue efficiency of 97.3%. And we still continue with very strict cost focus. We have a contract backlog of $293 million, and we are very much focused on securing new work for the Will Hunter. Market certainty does continue with respect to the timing and the shape of the recovery, however. And the company, our company, continues to evaluate opportunities for growth on a case-by-case basis. So that takes us to the end of the presentation, and we can move to the Q&A. So I'll hand back to Rosie, and Rosie, you can manage the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, please press star one again. You'll be advised when to ask your question. Ladies and gentlemen, please be reminded, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. Our first question will be coming from the line of Martin.
I was wondering, have you seen any tendering activity at all in the market in the North Sea?
Hi, Martin. It's John here. So, yeah, there is some tendering activity. There are, at this moment in time, there's one market inquiry and one, it's the first stage of a tender. One's with Nexen, which is for decommissioning activity, which would require a semi-submersible. The other one's with Talisman, that's also for decommissioning, required by a semi-submersible. And we see today that there was actually a contract award from Dana Petroleum to Diamond Offshore, which I think is for the Guardian, which wasn't marketed, so that was just a direct award, we understand. So that's three relatively large companies either tendering or doing activity, and we're kind of hopeful that this, certainly the decommissioning work will sort of gather pace going forward, and also hopeful that these tax stimulus measures will try and kickstart some kind of activity. That may be with the smaller operators, or it may be with the large ones, or a combination, but there is activity, and that's the extent of it at this moment in time.
Okay, great. Thank you. I was wondering also, the BOP for the Hunter, is that optional? So if there's no contract, will that still go ahead?
No, the BOP, we have the option to defer the big project, the SPS project, if you like, but the BOP itself is a very long lead commitment. In fact, it was ordered almost 2 years ago, and it's got stage payments. Now, because it's such a long lead item, we've decided to commit to that going forward, so that does give us the option of doing the SPS in the middle of next year, but pretty much everything else at this point, you know, we can defer. So we had to commit to that one because of the long lead nature of the that piece of equipment, keeping all our options open, basically.
There will, however, be the possibility to defer a portion of the cost in respect of installation, and that's, you know, about 25% of the overall BOP cost. But other than that, we're committed to the BOP.
Yeah, just to clarify, the 45 million or the 22.5 million per rig, that's made up of a cost for the BOP itself, and that's the bit that we're committed to. And there is a portion of ancillary equipment and installation cost, and some of that sort of that balance of that cost can be deferred, as Ian said.
Okay, thank you. Can you give the exact date for the end of the Well Phoenix contract?
It's a bit of a moving target because what happens, it was 3 years firm plus options. But within that 3 years firm, there's the SPS. So, you know, depending on how long the SPS takes.
The date, based upon a 60-day SPS, the final date is the 11th of November 2017.
Okay, thanks. And is the SPS period, is that paid?
No.
Okay, thank you. Those were my questions.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Akiva Rosenfeld, who's a private investor.
Private investor. Ze moeten die blow-up preventer dus toch helemaal betalen.
Yeah, hi.
Bonjour.
Hello, Akiva.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for a good quarter. Just want to ask, I see that there are a lot of cold stacked rigs in the market.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, are they higher spec rigs than the Will Hunter, or are they lower spec?
Let's have a look. So, I mean, everybody will have their opinion on how good the rig is. I mean, we've pitched ours very much as being you know, refurbished after the big Poland shipyard projects we did in 2011 and our track record. But looking at the list here, I would say there's four that are, five that are similar and one that's higher of the cold stack rigs out of the one, two, yeah, out of that. There's most of them, they're all except for one is similar capability.
So that means that people are, the companies are unsure even for the decently stacked rigs, right? That's just means that the market is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, different drilling contractors or rig owners have to take their own view on what they do with rigs when they come off contract. And you could say that the owners of the larger fleets with the bigger exposures were probably more likely to go to sort of a longer-term downtime to sort of limit their exposure to these costs. So, and you know, if you look at that list on page 16, you can see two of the larger fleet owners there going straight to coal when these rigs come off contract. So you could draw that conclusion from that.
Mm-hmm. And does that mean that that because you're just a smaller company that you'll try to market these rigs more, and you think you have more of options than the larger companies because they just have the they basically cold stack their old rigs and their newer specs they're trying to market, and basically you're basically trying to market whatever you have.
I'll go back to my original point. I think if you have a very large fleet and you start having lots of rigs coming off, the pressure financially is just to go straight to coal to limit that exposure. I think that's probably where the competition is sitting at the moment. But in terms of what we're doing, we're in the fortunate position that we've got one rig sitting inshore at the moment. We have actually been paid for it in this termination of this early release payment until the end of the year. We're working really hard to market this rig based on its previous performance. But as we go forward, we're very conscious that a fully crewed rig, even with some discounts we're sitting in, inshore, let's just say that fully stacked rig with a little bit of discount still brings us down to about low 70s in terms of OPEX. It's not a bottomless pit, so we continue to look at that and monitor that. Because if our view in the market was to change, we suddenly thought it's really cold and there's no work out there for a longer period of time, then, we might be thinking about going down to a minimum warm stack or, the worst case is we cold stack. But at the moment, we're working really hard to market this rig, and we're keeping all our options open by keeping it fully crewed, making it as attractive as possible because of that and because of our performance track record.
What about decommissioning work? Is it because that there are very few options of drilling further because of the low cost of oil? Does that mean that they'll try to defer their decommissioning costs because all the oil companies are in a tight spot now?
Well, it's, clearly CapEx is constrained, and it's a challenge within operators or customers. But at the same time, most operators have wells which they have to decommission at some point. And looking at the market now, if you compare day rates to what they have been, they're much more competitive pricing. So if you're going to do decommissioning, now is the time to sort of find some CapEx and get a rig at a more attractive price. And encouraging the operators to do that, no doubt, is the UK government, because their approximate 50% participation in the cost of decommissioning of any well is attractive to the operators and to the government. So it's a bit of a catch-22. Their budgets are constrained, but yet there's a great opportunity to try and undertake this legal requirement of decommissioning at a lower cost. And the Wilco Drilling with the Will Hunter has just completed a very, very extensive program for Hess, very successful program. And that's why we think we're very well suited to decommissioning in this market going forward.
So you think that that the companies will put you ahead because of your experience in decommissioning?
We hope so. We've got a good proven track record and a rig with a good operational performance. So we certainly helped ourselves in terms of being able to market the rig in that respect. That's certainly part of our conversations, and that's where we are.
And just one more question. In, let's say, worst-case scenario, that there isn't any other opportunities in the North Sea, is there option to move the rig?
Yeah, the rig can move, and being a UK-compliant rig with a UK safety case, it's relatively straightforward for it to move into other regions, the exceptions being Norway and Canada. They're the ones with a sort of similarly high spec compliance, but probably even more so than the UK. So with the exception of those two areas, it's relatively straightforward. But, in other areas, the markets are no more attractive. There's an oversupply of rigs in all other midwater regions. So, yes, we can do it, but there's no commercial reason to do it at the moment because... the market's the same all over the world for midwater.
Thanks. My questions were answered. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Our next question comes from William Mansfield from Barclays Assets.
Hello, William.
Hi there, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to follow up on a handful of the questions that were asked earlier, mostly having to do with the Will Hunter. I think I just heard you someone was asking you what's the approximate cost when you warm stack a rig, and I thought I heard you were saying $70,000 a day. Is that correct?
Okay, so there's no specific terms in the dictionary for hot stack and warm stack. I think every company has a different view on it. So if we take when we're operating, we have an OPEX of around about $85,000 a day. And if you remember, at the start of the year, we were sort of guiding higher than that, 100. So operating, we've brought from 100 down to 85. We've really been cost-focused. So that's when we're offshore working. Now, when we bring the rig inshore, and let's call that a hot stack, that's with all the same people, but we do slightly less maintenance, slightly less projects, there's maybe a little saving on insurance, etc. We can probably bring that number down to low 70s, but that is for a fully functioning rig. It's just ready to go at any time. If you then say, let's take it down to something called warm stack, which is some reduction in cost and activity, we would be looking around about $45,000 a day. There are lower cost versions of that if you want to do really minimum crew, and that's basically putting it down, just trying to avoid going to cold stack. And let's call that one a sort of lukewarm stack. You know, that one's about
27 to 30.
And then if you get right down to cold stack, and that's what's happening to some of the rigs in the UK from other owners, you're looking at somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 a day, and that's mostly to do with insurance and periodic sort of inspection. But, and here's the but, is that put something to cold stack that you expect to work again, you actually have some front and back loaded costs, and that is the cost and activity required to get the rig ready to be cold stacked. That's all the preparation. That's the sort of you know, the greasing of the motors and the preservation of electrical cabinets by putting bags of silicon gel in and all that kind of stuff. Basically, getting the rig to be mothballed. And then you have a similar lump of cost when you want to bring it out again, which is reactivating it, testing it, commissioning it, etc., all that sort of stuff. And if you say the lump of cost at the front and the back end added together is something like $4 to $5 million, that's a rough estimate. So you're $5,000 to $10,000 per day plus this $4 to $5 million the sort of front and the end of your cold stack commitment. And one thing to bear in mind is that $5,000 to $10,000 a day sounds quite attractive, but it makes it harder to market the rig. And also, really, you're kind of committing to long term. Otherwise, you've undermined the saving you've made with your going from warm stack down to the cold stack 5 to 10, because this $4 to $5 million has actually cost you more, and you've ended up with a rig that's not quite so attractive to market. So, cold stacking is quite a commitment to a longer term idle period for that reason.
Thanks for that explanation. Just to be clear, what you're currently doing is in the low $70,000 a day. Is that?
That's right. That's for a complete crew, everybody on, all the same maintenance, blah blah blah. It's ready to go. It's as if it was offshore.
And on a quarterly basis, that's $6 to $7 million, if I do my math right. Yeah.
Yes, in that region.
Okay.
One point to mention is that clearly that's a burn rate, as you described. Now we have obviously been paid effectively till the start of December from this settlement with Hess. But in saying that, it's really important to stress that we continue to monitor this situation. You know, is it the right thing to have it, you know, fully crewed going forward? So keeping our options open, it makes it more attractive to market the rig. But again, if our view changes on the market going forward, you know, we can do things differently. We can scale it back to one of those different levels if we decide to. But so we're very much focused on monitoring the market and the consequential spend on the Will Hunter crew.
I got that. And what you're kind of highlighting is your view on the market can change. Next week you might have a different view to, you know, or a month from now or something. It's very fluid.
It's very fluid. I mean, there was a new award today that I don't think anybody really saw coming. That was Diamond Offshore got a contract. I think it was a year with Dana for the Ocean Guardian, and you know, that was a really quick one. So you know, it's not impossible for things to sort of pop up like that. So we're marketing this rig really hard. It is a cool market, and in order to do that, the best way to position ourselves is, one, with a track record we've done, but two, to keep this rig hot. So there's none of this sort of startup risk which you normally get with a cold rig being reactivated.
All right, and then two more quick almost accounting questions. In the third quarter, because of the contract termination, you're going to pull forward earnings from the fourth quarter that would have happened into the third quarter because you got a lump sum payment. Is that right?
That's correct. So the full early release settlement amount will be recognized in quarter three, which is exactly as you stated there, effectively brings it forward because there's no revenue being earned. It's an early release payment, so that will be recognized in quarter three.
Okay. And then lastly, on the BOP, you were asked the question about you were explaining that some of the BOP, the $22.5 million for each BOP, but in particular for the one for the Will Hunter, is not related to the equipment itself, but is related to the installation of the equipment, and you potentially could not incur that charge if you don't upgrade the BOP on the Will Hunter. Aside from that operational component, have you paid out? I'm looking from a cash flow perspective, the remaining amount of the $22.5 million with respect to the Will Hunter, or the other rig as well, or is that a future cash incurrence in the next 6 months or so?
That would be future. What we've paid to date combined is about $14 million, and that's split equally between the two rigs. And for Will Hunter in particular, if we choose to defer the installation, then some of the ancillary equipment will be committed to, but the installation cost and some of the other equipment is some degree of flexibility, and we'd be able to defer approximately $8 to $10 million in respect of that.
Yeah. So from the $45 million, the $22 for the Will Phoenix, that will be spent.
Yeah.
From the 22.5 from the Will Hunter. Up to 8 could be saved from that 22.5 by deferring stuff, but the balance of that has to be committed because we want to take the BOP on time and some of the ancillary.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
But on a cash flow perspective, of the 45, you've spent 14 already, so there's 31 to go.
Correct.
And of the 31, you might not have to spend 8.
That's right.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for explaining all that. Very helpful.
Our next question comes from Jeremy Carter, who's a private investor.
Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, and thank you for taking my question. I'm looking at the balance sheet, and I see that you've got an equity of about $450,000. And then when I look at the market valuation of the company, it is less than a third of that, if my calculations are correct. Now, you mentioned that there was no need for any impairment costs. I'm just wondering how to balance the two situations together.
Okay, when we look at the impairment, we look at the net book value of the assets, and included in the rigs, machinery, and equipment, there's still an element of unamortized SBS, which isn't part of that impairment provision, and there is a small element of brand new equipment that still effectively has to be capitalized. So the underlying asset value is in the region of $207 million. And when we take a look at the remaining contract backlog and expenses relating to that and project further based upon assumptions through to the end of the estimated life of the assets, we have a net present value discounted at 10% in excess of the net book value. Now, as I mentioned earlier, in respect of quarter two, that's a positive situation that we're in. But as we progress through quarter three, we'll have to take a view. We will utilize one quarter's revenue in respect of the Will Phoenix and the remaining contract backlog. In respect of the Will Hunter, will all have been recognized by the end of quarter three, so there'll be no backlog beyond that point in time. And the board will take a view at the end of quarter three with regard to potential impairment. But that will be subject to how we see the market on a go-forward basis at that time.
I see. Was it a year ago? You increased your borrowings, and so you have a strong cash equivalent and you're paying interest on your borrowings and you're not getting much money, I presume, on your cash and cash equivalents.
That's correct. The borrowings that we had last year was total borrowings of 125, and after cost that was a net of about 122. We used approximately 100 to pay off the existing debt that we had with Transocean, and the 22 surplus, we anticipated the requirement in respect of the upcoming SPSs and the BOPs.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The next question will be coming from Alexander, who is from Global Partner.
Hello, Alexander.
Yes, hello, guys. Just up front, thanks a lot for the integrity and the way you present the company and the work you do for your shareholders. I think you do a fantastic job in an extremely challenging environment, and I was just making sure that you hear that from time to time.
Thank you.
Okay, so guys, I just have a minor question and then one in a little bit more detail that goes along the lines that was just asked before. Now, the minor question is, I noted that your account receivables have jumped and almost doubled, and I was wondering whether there is any connection that I should understand technically with regard to potentially Apache approaching you for a renegotiation of their current contract, or you mentioned that the last time on the call, or whether that's purely technical.
The trade and other receivables, I mean, that represents actual billed revenue at the end of the quarter, and you know what is still outstanding. And if you're looking at the column at the end of December 14, basically what would have happened is that one of our clients would have paid the outstanding receivable early.
Well,
and so that represents...
I see, yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Just a timing.
And so the other point I'd make is that both the trade and other receivables and the accrued revenue that was outstanding at the end of the quarter has all since been received in cash. So there's no issues with regards to receivables.
Okay, so then can you just quickly confirm if there is any risk of Apache renegotiating the contract of I think the last time you explained that your contract is quite safe, but maybe just can you highlight any risk in that contract that you see at the moment?
Well, the contract with Apache is a firm duration contract, and I think it'd be fair to say that a lot of operators are discussing with their respective drilling contractors about the current market conditions. But in terms of our contract, we have a contract. We'll work with a contract. We'll work to keep our customer happy. We'll very much focus on performance. If we can come up with some ideas which are mutually beneficial, we could look at that. But we are there to listen to our customer, our very important customer. We will work. We will work within the contract, which very much involves delivering our performance.
Yeah, and obviously I assume they need the rig and they want to complete the work, but in case they react as extreme as some other client announcements in the last couple of weeks, such as ConocoPhillips that just walked away from a contract, is there a termination agreement that allows them to walk away from the contract at a lower backlog than what you stated so far?
No, the contract's a firm term.
So that they can.
Okay. I mean, as long as the Wilco Drilling is, performing and working to the contract, but it's that's the contract.
Okay, fine. Okay, so then I'd like to come back to the impairment test, and I'd just like to understand that a little better because I think it goes back to the equity covenants you have in your bond agreement and the potential for impairment if markets don't improve. Can you just explain how the auditor will work with you on, discounting these cash flows, how backlog comes into play, what the discount rate is they use in IFRS, how they look at other, day rates in the market, or just looking at your contract, if you warm stack or or even cold stack, what the ramifications are in terms of impairment.
I'll give you a big picture thing, then I'll let Ian dive into the details or the accounting talk. So I think the big picture thing to remember is it's based on the remaining
remaining life of the assets,
remaining economic life. Yeah. So if you think about how much actual remaining life we've got with these rigs, we know these rigs will run to at least 2031. We've got 15 years from next year, which is 2016. We know that because we work with our certifying authority, DNV. We know the condition of the rigs, and providing that we keep rigs in good working condition and we do our SPSs to their satisfaction, these rigs can operate to 2031. So what will fill that time period in terms of contracts? Ian, over to you, and see how that falls out into impairment.
Yeah, I mean, the view that we take, obviously we've got a firm contract backlog that is fairly well defined through the remaining terms of the contract. And then beyond that, there certainly is a degree of speculation. And, you know, we would build into our scenario potential for long periods of downtime, seasonal work during the course of future years. So we're certainly not looking at a full 100% contract utilization. We've got quite a diminished level of future utilization, which is average over the remaining term. And then we take a view on what we think a cyclical market rate might be over a period of time. We also look at what the industry norm is with regards to like a weighted average cost of capital, and we have used 10%, which is quite penal by the time you look at cash flows that you have, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road. There's not that much net present value in respect of that. So, you know, we've been through the process. The board have reviewed it. The auditors have reviewed it. And whilst they don't review the quarterly results, they're not audited on a quarterly basis. Relatively recently, they reviewed the year-end results. I think that was in April when those were released.
Okay,
I guess to get back to the point where we are in a good position with regards to quarter two, but I do caution clearly that as we go through quarter three and we lose all of the Hess backlog and we lose a quarter of the Phoenix backlog with Apache, then the position at the end of quarter three may be different.
So is it fair to say that it's kind of a rolling mechanism, the impairment, the way the auditors look at impairment, so they're not going to say, look, the market outlook is more like 200,000K day rate and a 60% utilization, and that's even a fair assumption for the moment for the next 15 years, and ergo, you know, you have to impair Will Phoenix 100%. That's not the way they look at it.
No, they certainly don't set the variables. We make that determination.
Okay.
And then we talk through the process with the auditors.
And then review it every quarter, and so that they can still be comfortable on it.
Absolutely. We review that, and the board reviews that as part of the board meeting on a quarterly basis.
Yeah. Okay, but then it's fair to say that at some point you will have a tough time to fulfill the 35% equity ratio that you have in the bond financial covenants. Is that a problem?
Well, once again, that depends on a few factors. We've done our projections with regard to that particular covenant, and because we've got quite a high level of retained earnings, and you know, during the course of quarter three, that will be increased quite substantially because we're recognising that Hess revenue and the amount of impairment that we would have to recognise the next quarter, the quarter after, is well exceeded by the distributable reserves that we have and the retained earnings that we have for some time to come. But, you know, if the contracts don't appear, then over time there's a potential to go below the 35% threshold.
Yeah, okay. So maybe a good idea to buy back the debt before you get there, so you save some interest rates there. Anyway, that's just a view from far. But thanks a lot for the explanation. I think I understand the impairment test now a little better. It's obviously It seems that the management is driving it more than the auditors are. Is that a correct statement?
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, understood.
But clearly, they have an obligation to satisfy themselves that there is not an impairment issue when they sign off on the audited financials.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then I just one little question on OPEX. You have 87,900 per day at the moment, which is fantastic when I compare it to some of your competitors. But can you just say how much of that is personnel related, and then how many people work on a rig, so I have a better understanding what that kind of spec rig needs in terms of personnel?
It's approximately 50% of your OPEX is down to people. Yeah, and it's approximately 50 Awilco Drilling crew required to run a rig. Even though the rig can take 110 people, it's 50 Awilco Drilling crew and up to 60 extras can be there, and that's a combination of third parties we hire, but customer and customer third parties. So about 50 people in direct crew, approximately.
Yeah. And just to be clear, that is 50 people on board the rig, so there'll be an equivalent number back to back. So assigned to the rig will be a region of 100 people.
50 at one time, that's day and night shift.
And, I mean, in these extreme market situations, it's fair to say that you should be able to give back some of the pressure to your suppliers. Are these people hired by you, or are they third-party employed, which allows you to renegotiate some of the costs of the people?
They're employees.
Employees.
I mean, there's a small percentage that, you know, due to illness or something like that, sometimes, very occasionally you'll take an agency people, but they're employees.
Okay. And then maybe a last question on the strategic side, a little bit out of the box, and I'm aware that you probably won't say too much about it, but I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit. I mean, in a market like that, you still have what I would call quite a strong balance sheet compared to some of your competitors. And you're also in the mid-market up in the north, in Europe, and one or two of your competitors actually have a situation where they have a stronger backlog book than you guys, but a weaker balance sheet. Have you looked at combining, or would you have the support of your main shareholder to, look at some strategic combinations going forward?
You're right. I can't say too much about it.
Yeah.
No, joke. That's a joke. Awilco Drilling was formed on the back of a unique acquisition opportunity, and that was Transocean divesting two assets pretty much at the bottom of the last down cycle. And so Wilhelmsen and friends came together, and that started Awilco Drilling. So they spotted an opportunity, a very entrepreneurial opportunity. So going forward, Awilco Drilling, as you say, it's got a lot going for it, including low debt. The last bullet point in our last slide there was Awilco Drilling continues to evaluate opportunities on a case-by-case basis. So things are changing. There's a bit of stress out there. There's opportunities, and there may well be another opportunity that fits Awilco Drilling in some way. But, this opportunity to come potentially, and opportunities that we've looked at in the past 5 years, we have pretty strict financial discipline in terms of these opportunities have to add value to the company and shouldn't derail the existing business model. So that's not a case of growing for growing's sake. So using the same sort of entrepreneurial and opportunistic eyes, but very much looking for opportunities that add value, if that answers your question.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot for taking my questions, gentlemen. I think you answered them very nicely. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from David Bush, who's a private investor.
Hello, David.
Yes, good morning. I have some questions here about the Will Phoenix, the yard stay in 2016. And during that yard stay, are they going to be doing the BOP and the SPS?
Yeah, so just to confirm one thing, the SPS and the Will Phoenix could well be November, December, the end of 15, or it could be early 16. So there's quite a few factors still in play at the moment, which will help us land out on the final date. But when the project starts, it is scheduled for 60 days off hire, and that includes mobilization and demobilization. So that is 60 days off hire. That's the plan at the moment. Now, some people refer to it as an SPS project, but it's actually bigger than that. The correct term is a yard stay project, and within that, three different areas of activity will happen. The first area is overdue maintenance or work on the rig that can't be done during its 5 years when it's actually working offshore, and that's sort of taking engines and cranes apart. The second one is any upgrades, and in our case, that is installing the BOPs, the new BOPs and the new BOP control system and the upgraded BOP handling systems. And then finally, the actual SPS work, the inspection work, working with the DNV to make sure that the steelwork integrity is all up to standard and all this kind of stuff. You know, the alarms are working and blah, blah, blah. So there's three areas of work. There's deferred maintenance, there's upgrading, and there's SPS inspection work. So that's all wrapped into what we call the yard stay project, and that's within the 60 days off hire that we've planned for.
Okay. I guess it would be... It'd be impossible, I guess, at this point, because the yard is planned in advance to postpone it, perhaps to the end of the contract with the Apache.
Well, we can postpone it. We're in negotiations with the yard at the moment. That contract hasn't been quite sealed yet, but there is a lot of availability for yards at the moment in this quiet period. So I don't think deferring a project gives us an issue per se in terms of availability to facilities. But there is actually a drop dead date. For our SPS, you get a 5-year ticket, if you like, and you must SPS the rig again by the end of that 5 year. There is a little bit of leeway for things like if you're doing a well in progress, etc. But we've got an absolute backstop of doing this SPS. I think is it May or June?
May
in 2016. But we're all set up at the moment to go. We're aiming for the end of 15 or the start of 16, depending on all these variables. But we do have a drop-dead date that we can't go past in terms of our 5 years are up.
Oh, and that's up in 2016?
Yeah, in May 16, as Ian's just reminded me.
Oh, okay, yeah. Just for the long-term outlook for oil prices, I mean, you'd have to have, first of all, to really figure that out, I guess, but at what price would you just guesstimate, because, you know, this would just be guesswork, really, at what price would you see the chance for the Will Hunter to be, you know, recommissioned, to be, you know, to get another contract? At what price do you think that would be almost a certain deal that they would be able to get a new contract, or what kind of oil price would you get?
That's a very difficult thing to answer that question. I think you're asking what trigger price gets the UK fleet back into full utilisation. I think it's quite as simple as that. I think even at this low oil price, some people are still engaging. As I said earlier in the call, that's Dana Petroleum decided they're going to go and hire a rig for a year. And there's certainly talk about... There's certainly talk about others potentially going for some drilling activity, but no tenders as such. But the probably what's going to happen first is the decommissioning work, and that is essentially hiring a rig to, you know, undo a well, drill a well in reverse, if you like. So there is still some demand, whether it's drilling or whether it's decommissioning. What is the trigger date for getting it all going? Well, you know, we were high numbers, and it was full utilization in the UK fleet, and those high numbers were $90, $100, $110, and then there was a sort of undersupply of rigs. Once you start moving down towards sort of 70, you can see a sort of immediate cooling, and then where we are at 50, it's very hard to get things going. So there's no rule of thumb, but clearly $50 doesn't help anybody.
Right. Okay. All right, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Joe Gianfrido, who is a private investor.
Hello, Joe.
Oh, good afternoon. Just one question. What's your drop-dead date for decision to proceed or push out the April yard stay for Will Hunter?
Drop dead date. So we've kept our options open with the long lead item, which is the BOP.
I'd say certainly with regard to the expenditure that we incur in respect to the SPS, the bulk of that expenditure is current expenditure at the time when the work is actually done. So there's very little in respect of long lead time items within the actual SPS expenditure itself. Some of the CapEx that we will have that we're looking to install as part of the yard stay project, we're just keeping a very, very close eye on that to make sure that we don't get into a position where we can't order with sufficient time left to install that during the SPS period. So it's the bulk of the SPS stuff is fairly imminent. Some of the capital items will have potentially 6 months lead time for some critical items.
Yeah, I mean that's not rather than a drop dead date. That's a continual review of do we want to keep our options open and looking at long leads as they pop up, whether that's small cost or high cost, capex with a sort of respective delivery times. But really, the big spend, the main spend for SPS doesn't actually start till the first day of the project. And with the flexibilities we have at the yard, we can just continue to push that to the right if we need to.
Great, thanks. That answers my question.
Okay, we have a follow-up question from the line of Akiva Rosenfeld.
Yeah, hi. Sorry for just want to get back one more question. Do your lenders have any say in what and what not you could do with the Will Hunter, if you call stack at warm stack at the SPS or whatever?
No, they don't. The bond has specific covenants, which is in respect to the equity ratio and minimum liquidity.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like a collateral.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no further questions, so I'll hand you back to your host to conclude today's conference.
Okay, Rosie, thank you very much for hosting it, and thank you to the participants on the call for listening in to Awilco Drilling's Q2 2015 earnings call. So thanks again for listening, and goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's conference. You may now replace your handsets. Thank you.